This is Liberty Law Talk, part of Liberty Fund's online library of law and liberty. Your host is Liberty Fund fellow Richard Reinsch. Our web address is libertylawsite.org, where you can subscribe, comment, find other episodes and links related to today's conversation. Our email address is lal@libertyfund.org. Today we are talking with Bill McClay about America's mixed patriotism. Bill McClay is going to fit in well on this podcast. He holds the Blankenship Chair in the History of Liberty, a chair devoted to teaching students about the evolution of the concept of liberty in Western civilization. He's an award-winning historian. His book, The Masterless, Self and Society in Modern America, won the 1995 award, the Coetzee Award of the Organization of American Historians for the best book in American history. He's widely published in addition to books, essays, and a lot of publications. He's been teaching for a number of years, and Bill, we're just glad to have you on the program and discuss several essays you've written on patriotism, nationalism, most recently an essay in National Affairs on patriotism.
Richard, I'm delighted to be with you and honored.
Well, great. Well, so I want to just sort of jump in here and think about your case for patriotism. So let's get into the mixed patriotism in a moment, but you begin with two observations. One is that the dispositions that form patriotism are more visceral than intellectual, you say. They're grounded in our natures and the basic facts of our natality. You say their power is no less for that, and they are denied at great cost. Isn't that the problem, though, that our elites have with patriotism? It's that visceral nature. It's that sort of, you know, the hair stands up on the back of your neck when you hear the Star-Spangled Banner or a military band player, something like that, and that bothers sort of the rationalism of our elites, their cosmopolitanism, that somehow this is something that cannot be controlled.
Yeah, it's the exclusivity of it, that the fact the non-inclusiveness of it, that to favor what is my own is somehow to disfavor that of others, there's actually, you know, there, it's not necessarily a disposition I would say is wholly bad. I mean, it comes out of a certain kind of abstract generosity, but it can reach absurd lengths. I remember doing a seminar with the Jack Miller Center, with which I'm associated, on looking at sort of Martha Nussbaum's take on patriotism, and which is very negative, of course, and it came down to the question of, well, would you favor other people's children over your own, or would you go out of your way to treat them equally? And the people there who were all, you know, advanced graduate students or junior professors, almost all took the opinion took the position that, the principle of equality, you know, the veil of ignorance and so on and so forth would dictate that you wouldn't treat your own child any differently. And I think this is, this is deeply, deeply violative of our natures, and that, in fact, the preference of a mother for her own child is something universal. It becomes warped when you try to supersede it with a universalistic principle. It is our universal disposition to favor the particular, to favor what is ours. It's sort of paradoxical when you state it that way. But yeah, I think the universalism, rationalism, the kind of egalitarianism, all of these understood in abstract and dogmatic and decontextualized form are I think the sources of resistance. There's also, I don't talk about this in the essay, but I love Roger Scruton has this notion of oikophobia. The dislike. I dislike the whole phobia sort of suffix, but I'll use it anyway. the dislike, distaste for what that which is one's own, for one's homeland, for one's oikia. That is something that is, if I may put it this way, visceral with the college educated. I even find it, I think it's being inculcated in high schools, although it doesn't run very deep. When I started teaching almost 30 years ago, and, you know, I'd have in first semester survey courses, you know, I'd have high school students. This was at Tulane, at the University of Tennessee. You would find that, you know, there's a certain kind of rote answer that students give to questions where they don't really know what they want to say, but they think what's expected of them is to say X, and so they say X. And in 30 years ago, it was X was the United States is the greatest nation on in the history of the human race, and so on. So it was fairly mindless, but that was what they thought was expected of them, and they may even have believed it to some extent. Now, that the expected answer is, it's a sort of Obama apology tour version.
We've got a lot of
American
problems.
History.
Yeah.
And we really shouldn't think we're better than anybody else. In fact, we're probably worse. And
yes.
we've been arrogant.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. You mentioned Obama and think about the oikophobia with Roger Scruton. A couple things come to mind. You know, Barack Obama in the campaign 2008. Obviously, part of this in reaction to George W. Bush and the Iraq wars and the fallout of all of that. If you go back to that time, and Barack Obama in Berlin, I think it was in Berlin, said that he was.
Yes.
He said, "I'm a citizen of the world."
Yeah.
And
yes.
And think about that, and what could that possibly mean? Kind of connecting that with your observation of favoring your own. I mean, that is part of what patriotism is about, that you actually do want the people in your country whom you have a shared history with to somehow receive benefits for that, to have sort of a connection with them across different contexts. And
So
Obama says, "I'm a citizen of the world." What could that, what could that possibly really mean in practice when we think about how human beings actually live politically together?
Yeah, and the fallacy there is not just the sort of absence of a rich and robust cultural nexus that we all those of us who are in a state of that sort of solidarity with one another actually have. There's also a kind of mistaken positing of a civic ideal that doesn't really exist. There, you can't be a citizen of something that in which you don't have certain very particular rights and duties and
yes.
and shared memories, shared historical landmarks, shared sufferings, and those can be actually one of the great things about this country is that we have many people who come to share in that by appropriating it. In a sense, we all appropriate it. I mean, I wasn't there at Lexington and Concord, and neither were you. But it's for Italian, African, Asian immigrants that too, as they become assimilated, becomes part of the heritage that they appropriate. It is American. It isn't, even though it's open to all sorts of people with all sorts of backgrounds, it's still particular. It's still ours. Getting back to the civic notion, I mean, there is, and this is one of the issues with the EU and Brexit and the whole fraying of the EU that's going on right now, is that you can't really be a citizen of a political order that lacks a real constitution, that lacks a real legal ordering mechanism by which those who rule are answerable in some way to those being ruled, particularly if we're thinking in terms of democratic societies. But that's to be a citizen of the world would only be meaningful if there was a real and functioning world government that had a world constitution that had been ratified in a proper way. And nothing like this has happened. Nothing even remotely resembling that has happened. And even the EU, as a kind of proto-global state, doesn't follow that pattern.
No,
go ahead.
It was the interesting. The European Union, Pierre Manon has said of it that it's not a government; it's governance. There's nothing like real politics happening in the European Union. The most powerful body in the European Union, and the names escape me of all the different EU institutions, but it's a rulemaking institution. It's not a parliament.
Yeah, it's the administrative state par excellence.
It really is, and the authority of the European Union can only grow, Manon and Scruton would argue, at the expense of the nation states, which is precisely why we see them, I think, operating in the manner that they do when they challenge certain local countries or certain countries in the European Union, resisting or challenging their authority in various ways. Mm-hmm. It's interesting, too, just thinking about your piece here, I mean, I think this is an important part of it. You build on Aristotle's famous observation that man is by nature a political animal. What is this? How does this manifest in patriotism? How does this produce the patriotism?
Well, that it really, patriotism is not something super added to our nature. It's not some kind of add-on gizmo, something that is an enhancer, that we sort of add on to the basic and fundamental structure of our being. It is intrinsic that we are belonging creatures by nature. Now, I don't want to get into what exactly Aristotle meant by political animal, because it's not easily,
right,
as not easily rendered in our terminology, but it certainly does relate to belonging, and it does relate to belonging in a participatory way, that not just in a passive way. It's more than culture. It involves the sort of active agency of the citizen.
That's interesting.
An active belonging.
Yeah.
But the point is that it is. It's part of who we are. It is not a optional sort of extrinsic factor. It is part of who we are that we and there's a whole sheath of cliches, no man is an island, et cetera,
kind of
support this idea. But it is it only seems odd in a culture, a civilization that emphasizes the individual and the individual as much as we do, which is not an entirely bad thing by any means, but you can have a sort of hypertrophy of the idea of individualism, which I think we do suffer from.
Yeah.
And Aristotle is great for reminding us of these sort of home truths about the way in which our connection to one another is intrinsic to who and what we are.
Thinking about the belonging, and you're saying that's a part of our nature. That's interesting. Also, if we kind of just put that into contemporary discourse, because I think there's this notion of patriotism, nationalism; those are conflated wrongly, and then we have and that's bad because nationalism isn't really a part of our nature. It's something we invent. Or it is a part of our nature, but in a very bad tribal way that we displaced as moderns, and it manifested itself, say, in World War I. Although
right.
I would argue it manifested itself according to modern ideologies that sort of used it as a host to attack other people, and then also World War II are kind of brought in. These are sort of the things, particularly in Europe, maybe not so much in the United States, particularly in Europe, that discredit nationalism, which is really patriotism, they say, and it cuts against something that's very, very much part of, sort of saying of who we are as human persons.
Yeah, and this gets to the mixed patriotism idea that you know, Orwell makes this what really very useful distinction between patriotism and nationalism. That patriotism is the more sort of Burkean, little platoons, a small scale loyalty. You know, this land, this England. You know, that sort of sentiment, and that nationalism is much more abstract. It's more something constructed consciously as an organization, a mechanism of power. It is ersatz. You know, it doesn't sort of organically grow up. Instead, it's built around invented symbols like flags and myths. You know, Eric Hobsbawm his notion of the invention of tradition as a kind of con job of the nation state. There's actually a certain amount of truth to that. I mean, I have enough of a libertarian streak in me to see the merit of that skepticism of the nation state, which for me translates into skepticism of the administrative state as well. It doesn't seem to do that for people on the left for some reason, but
right.
But the same, what the American constitutional system brilliantly does, and if we would only sort of follow it,
yeah,
we'd be much better off, is to understand that these are both, that there is a legitimacy, particularly in the modern world, for the forms of organization that we associate with the nation state, but that doesn't eliminate the fact that that patriotism, in the more Burkean elemental sense, remains both a human need, a need to affiliate and belong to some particularity, and a form of belonging that, if it is extended to a scale beyond, you know, the local, beyond what more or less is face to face or approaching that, then it becomes it can become something sinister, you know. The whole trope favored particularly by you know, the left, I remember Mario Cuomo's notion of the nation as a family. This is really dangerous talk. Robert Nisbet used to argue that the whole notion of a national community is nonsensical.
It was interesting that, you think about the 2012, I think, Democratic National Convention, that government is the only thing we all belong to.
Yes, right,
and,
right.
And then you join that with the famous Life of Julia campaign cartoon Obama, of a single woman who largely goes through life single, has a child. We never meet the father or anything. It's just sort of the ways in which government enables her to be single. But as I thought about that, it seems that in a way is an attempt to posit the government community that you're speaking of, because we've cut out the memories, the battles, the events, the things that have actually shaped America into this thing that we are. And you talk about that in your piece with the mixed patriotism, that this is a part of America as much as the ideas matter regarding citizenship, the famous natural rights grounding we have. There is this shared memories, shared events,
yes,
in American history. And I suppose what one continually sees is the attempt to discredit those in large measure,
yes,
or redefine,
yes,
them. Or, yeah.
And I would also include that there are memories that we don't share nationally, that are peculiar to our regions, to our people of our shared, you know, ethnic or religious or other background, and actually, this, which goes under the inadequate term of pluralism, but this aspect of our society also is very healthy, as long as it's in tension with, and in some way contained by, a national ideal. But I think let me indulge me for a moment in a little story in this regard that meant to illustrate the way in which that the allowing the national and national politics in particular to supersede everything else, how impoverishing that is. A number of years ago, my wife and I were traveling in Italy, and we were on a train. I forget where we were going, but we were the only other ones in the car were a couple American couple, somewhat older than us. The husband, I still remember, looked exactly like Pete Seeger. And so he was wearing sandals with, you know, wool socks, you know, like whole thing. And after a while, we struck up a conversation. We had a glorious time talking to one another. And they were from New York and, you know, upstate, at any rate, that finally they asked us where we were from, and that time we were living in Tennessee, and so we told them we were from Tennessee, and it was as if we had just confessed to being Nazis or something really awful, and the conversation stopped. They just couldn't interact with us anymore now that they knew this horrible thing about us. And finally the husband said, Pete Seeger said, well, I guess there's some enlightened people in the red states.
Yeah.
And I thought, how what a shame. Uh-huh. I mean, I felt pity for him at that moment, more than being annoyed, because I thought, you know, this country is so rich and various, and I love traveling around the country and sort of taking in the variety of aspects of American life, which admittedly, if you stay on the interstates, you never see anything but interstates, and you think it's all the same. But this guy was so much of his consciousness was taken up with this leveling concept of red states and blue states that is useful for some things, of course, but it really only describes a tiny, very national aspect of the
right.
complex reality of this nation. And you think about the nation that way, and it becomes that way after a period of time. So,
I thought it's interesting. I thought, you know, one sort of promising thing Donald Trump has said since he's been president, I thought, was in his inauguration address, he talked about patriotism. And he went on and on. And what he said was, this is actually the way an incredibly divided country. There are aspects to American patriotism that could really unite us if you let it. And I've kind of thought, of course, the speech was, you know, difficult to take in at times, but I thought that line was actually promising. When I was reading your essay, it resonated with me, because the mixed patriotism, that way of balancing this universal in particular, that's something that we actually could work with amidst all of these sorts of questions and worries that, you know, there's nothing really that unites Americans anymore. We're sort of flying apart or at each other's throats, or California wants to secede, or things like that. But there's this part that has made us into this country that we can easily tap into if we want to.
Yes, and the fact that the term can mean so many different things to different people is not necessarily a bug. It may be a feature.
Yeah.
It may be something that there are things in the country's past that people, you know, on all different areas of the political spectrum can take pride in or find solace in. That, well, you know, there have been times before when the country was ruled by idiots, but it's come through it, so on. And if you can only take pride in your region or something like that, well, that's intrinsically connected to the nation. So it becomes a roundabout way, but a way nonetheless that back to a kind of generalized affection for the nation. I think too, though, that, and this is something that my friend and colleague Jim Caesar has been very articulate about, that and other people too, that what's really disturbing at times, and I think you see it on both sides of the aisle, as they say, but is the loss of a sense of gratitude that in the country, and gratitude does ultimately mean a recognition that what we enjoy in the present is in some way the product of the past and of individuals in the past towards whom, you know, our feelings of gratitude need to be directed. And I, by the way, I mean, I think gratitude as a concept, not everybody would agree with this, but I think gratitude as a concept implies something, maybe even someone, to be grateful to, towards which our gratitude is directed. I think its gratitude has that directionality built into its nature. And if you think of the world and you think of your society as simply something that was constructed or came about in an abstract way by abstract forces, that there's no there's nothing to be grateful to. Just as, you know, the yes. doctrine of natural selection doesn't sort of rules out any reason to be grateful to nature for blindly producing results that you happen to like.
The modern individual has a hard time with gratitude, I think. We all do to a certain degrees because we are so caught up in what we're making, what we're producing, what we're doing, and we don't understand that there are gifts. There are gifts, and we also don't think about the ways in which our lives have been shaped by people who had no material incentive in it, but who have contributed the most to us in various ways. It's interesting that the gratitude and the piety, though, are in abundance in so many, you know, Americans, but just not where they need to be, not in the academy, not in the chattering classes. It's not exactly there. And I think it's interesting. You talk about Irving Berlin in your piece, God Bless. And you talk about the God Bless America. And I never knew this. So he was a czarist, Russian immigrant, Israel Berlin. And that in a way, sort of, that's a powerful point you made there. Because if we think about, and many on the American right would say this, you choose to become an American. It's a propositional nation. We're a set of principles and ideas, and they're open to anyone. And there's truth to that, but it's not the whole truth. And Berlin actually constructs this song, which is rooted in memories. And history and traditions. Oh, he's an immigrant, Russian immigrant. Yeah.
There's no propositional America in the God Bless America. It's all sentiment that in the Heimat, as I say in the article, it's all about home. You know, that God Bless America, my home sweet home. That's how the song concludes the chorus. So. The Great American Songbook, which is a real passion of mine, the American popular music, roughly between 1920 and 1960. There are few that splash off of either end, but it's basically in that period. You know, so many of those composers and lyricists were immigrants, often, you know, sort of Eastern European Jewish immigrants, as were the people who really created Hollywood in the golden age of the studio system, you know, Goldwyn, Louis B. Mayer, you know. And how is it that people who, for whom the great, they created a lot of the great American iconography, the iconography of the West, of the Western. This is created by people who really weren't a part of that. How is that? It has something to do with more than memory. It does have to do with a certain kind of American idea of the possibility of self-realization beyond the cave of our culture, the cave, I'm invoking Plato here, but the cave of our natality. And that's part of America too. And I think it would be traducing what this country is and has been to deny that in some way, even, you know, the Walt Whitman song of the open road is is very much a part of what we are, that kind of liberatory thrust.
It seems, though, which you kind of outlined this, or others have pointed out, but the Walt Whitman story becomes the dominant story.
Then it becomes very...
That's sort of my question to you, is thinking about patriotism in America, but it seems to me there was a point where things got really complicated in terms of sort of this just remembrance of our past for many people, for reasons that matter. But there was somewhere we got cut off, it seems to me. And I think of, I don't know, the summer of 68 or things like that, that sort of a new way of thinking inserted itself in it and became very problematic to just sort of be an American patriot.
Yeah, well, and I think this impulse to kind of clean up the past by going around and you know, Robespierre-like, tearing down monuments to people who in one way or another displease us, or some of us, those of us who have the power to insist that they be torn down. I mean, look, I'm all for localities debating these things, and you know I'm actually sympathetic in some instances to people wanting to make those changes. That those decisions are theirs to make. That's part of self-rule. And I think self-rule is a concept that's missing from a lot of American education.
That's the thing about being governed in the sense of how we now are. We are much more passive. Much more willing to accept a certain amount of rule over us, and I suppose that's what made 2016 such an explosive year, both with Brexit, with the Donald Trump campaign, that no one, leaders on the left and the right, could really understand or predict or think about, and it just sort of emerged. And I think connected to the patriotism is the reemergence of the nation in Western politics and Western life, and that in and of itself says to me. I mean, one of the things I've thought it could mean is a need for something to transcend the self. That we're seeing how empty the modern self really can be. And a lot of people, not just in America, but other countries, particularly in Europe, are also sort of looking for something that, you know, transcends their immediate moment, that they can actually belong to, give themselves to, and support.
I think that there's a lot in what you just said. I do think one of the things that I've been really upset about in the wake of 2016 is that people, and these I include among these people who are very good friends, therefore I won't name them, but who seem just absolutely doggedly committed to not understanding what happened to them in 2016 and learning from it. They sort of doubling down in the misunderstandings that helped to produce the Trump nomination and then election. It does seem to me it's not hard to understand why issues like unrestricted immigration and inattention to questions of legality relating to immigration upset people. And you can quote all the statistics about comparative advantage and so on that you want. You can accuse people of xenophobia all you want. But you have to at some point address their experience and their sympathy you show to your fellow Americans, the situation which they believe they find themselves. I don't see that happening.
I think it, you know, it was also, I think it was this, but it goes back to the beginning of the interview, is the sense of, the economics, I get the economics work out in theory, and I'm told that, you know, these jobs will leave, but new and better jobs will replace them. But some of it's just like an inability to understand what your neighbor is going through, and that you might need to adjust in some way. And that wasn't present. The immigration thing, I mean, I think it played out obviously very kind of, you know, gross and obscene at times, but it was this recognition too of a past of a people, a memory of a people, thinking of that's produced certain notions of American citizenship, and that's all sort of not preeminent. What's preeminent is economics and multicultural ideology, and not thinking broadly about what American citizenship means and fits into that debate. And that,
absolutely,
of course,
right.
And that touches. I can't speak to European countries that way because I don't understand them nearly as well as I understand my own. But that all played out, and it was almost as if you didn't need to think politically anymore about what it meant to be an American. There was an economic answer on the right, and a multicultural answer on the left, and both were missing something important.
And in a demographic in dimension, as we're now seeing, it's now kind of coming out as a conscious strategy to really change the makeup of the country in a way to favor the Democratic Party in Texas and other places. I mean, it's not hard to show. They haven't really been hiding the ball on that. But what maybe even...
Well, if you accepted the emerging Democratic majority thesis, then it all started to make sense in that regard. Yeah, I mean, certainly we know the Labour Party in the United Kingdom. I mean, they said it red-handed. I mean, they were caught red-handed in memos saying they were trying to alter the demographic landscape.
And this is unfortunately. I mean, even if that strategy were to work, you've really unleashed terrible forces when you think you can kind of put Humpty Dumpty back together again, having shattered him. Are you going to sort of reconstitute a new sense of citizenship built around this new demographic entity? Probably, good luck. I don't think it can be done. You have to build on in a constructive way on what the nation has been in order to carry it into things that it might yet be. This kind of transformation by subterfuge and against the will of and against the interests, real or perceived, of the existing citizenry is a terrible, terrible misperception of what ultimately is in the interest of the country.
So we had, it's interesting as well on the right, thinking about patriotism. At the time, and this has changed somewhat, but at the time, both intellectually and then leading, like Paul Ryan comes to mind, American patriotism just was the Declaration of Independence and just the second paragraph. And that was the way we were taught. I think of, it was argued, Irving Kristol, great essay, essay on America just as a propositional nation. And I think that I've thought to myself, did that alone make them unable to understand the sort of wellspring that, or, you know, the angst that was rising amongst their own voters?
Yeah, I mean, I would defend Irving as not really taking the position in toto, more generally, you're right. I mean, this has been a big mistake, no less a person than Walter Burns, who I really loved for all his crustiness, wrote that book, Making Patriots, and it really does amount to a sort of ode to all men are created equal, and as the be all and end all of American national identity, and it just isn't.
Yeah.
There's all sorts of other things that go with it. There's a certain kind of demeanor, which includes the gratitude I spoke of a moment ago, that the Democratic citizen has to acquire, and it includes a knowledge of the past. It includes Burke said quite rightly that if you don't, those who don't have a kind of reverence and respect for the past are not going to have any regard for the future. It's absolutely right.
Yeah.
So all of these things, there's a whole, you know, back in the 90s, we had this debate over creed versus culture, you know, that, and this is sort of a variant on that, is the essential character of American life creedal, that is, propositional, or is it cultural? Is it, and I think the right answer is it's both. And they exist in a kind of creative tension with one another, keeping one another honest, keeping one another grounded. I think if you have too much of one and a crowding out of the other, you really lose the promise of America. And
you mentioned Walter Burns. You know, something he said that I thought he was very right on with patriotism. It's patriotism and a free Republican country like America creates the problem of teaching. He said teaching it to the next generation. And I know that's a big question, but it's gotta be one you've thought a lot about. I'll just ask you, are we doing that well, poorly, or
no.
Not at all? Yeah. Yeah.
I think we're doing it poorly. I wish we were doing it not at all. Leave a neutral. No, and I think it's really hard to swim against the tide of an utterly corrosive, noxious popular culture. I work with one of the really fun things about my job at the University of Oklahoma is I work with high school teachers. I do summer institutes for high school teachers to sort of enrich their teaching. And I know there are a lot of good people, public, private school, all kinds of schools, homeschool parents. There are a lot of people who are trying very hard to push back against that. So that's a given that you're operating in a somewhat polluted atmosphere how do you deal with it? It's very hard. It's hard as a parent. I know. I'm happy my kids are grown. I have a lot of sympathy for people who have to now deal with
that includes
countless
me. That includes
challenges.
Me.
Yeah.
But I think it's interesting. So how does a country that's losing its stories and memories and all of these things? I mean, so Abraham Lincoln. You know, in a famous speech in 1838, I think it was, at the Young Men's Lyceum, talked about reverence for the law, since we can no longer be connected to our founding, and we're losing even the people who were there. How do we reconnect? And so he proposes reverence for the law. So I have no idea how to translate that now, or how that would conjugate a 21st century America, but ways in which. You know, it could be brought back or instilled. I think the late Samuel Huntington had an idea, but it was almost fascistic, the ways in which he wanted to reinstitute kind of an Americanism. But I suppose it also explains the ways in which
Huntington,
Donald Trump appealed.
Huntington did want to bring back a sense that the West is not the sort of universal culture. America is not the universal culture that we're much better off if we think of ourselves as having our own ways. I don't go all the way with him on that. I actually think there is a kind of universal truth to certain aspects of our culture. I mean, I do buy into that to a certain extent.
Well,
even
Edmund Burke did, who you mentioned in the essay, he's always criticized for not producing some sort of coherent teaching, but systematic teaching. But you think about the way he addressed the Warren Hastings impeachment in India, and Warren Hastings said, you know, he brutalized the Indians for their own good because their manners were so coarse. It was the only way he could govern them. And Edmund Burke said, he doesn't use human rights, but you can never offend against the natural right of man or something like that.
Yeah, there is a kind of natural law instinct there in Burke. Yeah, I agree.
Thinking about this universal teaching, though, it can be incredibly self-justifying, self-serving, and flattering to us, and we forget that our actual political order, the Constitution, itself really fits us alone and our unique experience as colonies, independent states who then join together to repel the British. And then, you know, the history that grows out of that with our Constitution is not something one can just transport. You know, as one thought, George W. Bush.
Yes.
George W. Bush, every heart desires freedom. Well, you know, and, you know, that
maybe
that,
not.
Maybe they desire obedience and servility, but even if they desire freedom, the commitment, the institutions, the compromises, all the things that go along with that aren't necessarily going to be there. He didn't seem to understand.
Well, and I would go further and say that, you know, there's a kind of attribution of false consciousness that comes from the right as well as from the left. I mean, we're more familiar with it from the left, but you know, if you're saying people would, their hearts would desire freedom if they if only they would let us sort of liberate them into a knowledge of what they really desire. That this to me is the false consciousness argument, except it's coming from a side that we find more more liberatory and more generous. But you know, the one thing that Keynes was right about is that in the long run we're all dead. I mean, in some ways, you know, you have to show a regard for people as they are, as they present themselves, and not as the way they can be imagined to be educated and transformed by education. And that's the great problem of statesmanship, and one that I think,
which is also the mark. Maybe we can end on this. Is also the mark of a healthy patriotism, of a sane patriotism, that as much as you value what you are, you recognize the limits and the differences.
Yeah,
what it is.
Yeah, and in some way, I if I could just one
sure.
A very simple thing, but you know, I think one of the real problems with, and I guess I feel it much more coming from the left right now, because the left is so culturally in the commanding the heights, but. There's really a sense that there's a significant part of the country that wants to see the part of the country it doesn't like disappear, that it is not prepared anymore to coexist with it, even in kind of fierce contention or, you know, constant annoyance, whatever, but to say, well, you know, I may loathe X's views, but we are still fellow Americans. I don't. That disposition seems to be missing, and along with it, we've seen a loss of the concept of toleration as something that is not at all the same as acceptance. You know, you tolerate things that you disagree with, that you find detestable, even, but you recognize that there's some way in which a civilization demands that those positions and those individuals be allowed to exist freely. And I think the whole impulse to control speech, to control thoughts, to restrict access to channels by which thoughts can be promulgated and expressed and debated, this is very worrisome. And it is part of the world I live in, you know, higher education.
Yeah.
Where you know, it is you know, the notion of free inquiry, and this is not a myth that the current generation really has to be persuaded that these are good things. They are kind of earnest about it, about their. And I'm not talking about social justice warriors. I'm talking about regular old, kids that in every other respect, you know, are. Likeable and earnest and hardworking and so on, but they really wonder if it's worth it to have
debate.
A speech environment which difficult points of view are contentious points of view are really allowed a hearing. So that's one of the things that I think we need to take aim at. That's not going to re-engender patriotism, though.
No, but it's explainable by the loss of a sort of middle ground connecting tissue that patriotism can provide and bind people who are who can who are so different, but yet can accept and live with difference and live to fight another day instead of, you know, thinking every political battle is ground zero, blah, 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 you know.
We have, I mean, this is the fruition of you know, a long period of decline. You know, I remember in the 90s, one of the, you know, we were having the so-called culture wars then, and I mean, it was a kind of explicit thing, and, you know, we had debates over the national history standards and so on. And I remember there was a guy named Gerald Graff from Northwestern, an English professor, who caused a kind of a stir because he came up with this idea that hey, we didn't have to have a canon, we didn't have to have a sort of required knowledge. He said, what we can do is teach the conflicts. And it seems like such a brilliant solution to the where there's lack of consensus is just teach. Well, some people think this and some people think that. But that was an evasion. That was an evasion of the real need to take a stand for certain things.
I think I was the recipient of some of that teaching. Yeah.
What?
I think I was the recipient of some of that teaching.
Yeah, I think you probably were. You probably were. And it is, I think it's a great evasion, and now we need to find our way back to certain kind of some affirmations that are foundational, and we don't have them. You know, I've been working on an American history textbook that is, and it's been a real joy because I think we'll see how it does once it's out, but I think I have found a way of rethinking the American narrative. A lot of the problem with textbooks, by the way, is they're just too clotted with sidebars and factoids that are put in there mostly to satisfy textbook committees and for marketing reasons, sort of combination of political and marketing reasons. And when you can have one person writing the book, and I thankfully have a publisher that's letting me do what I want to do, We'll see what comes of it, but I think there is it's a very capacious narrative. I mean, there's room for everybody in it. There really is, if it could be understood in the right way. But you know, one of the subtlest things that Obama did that I really found distasteful, but it's very subtle, was this refrain of "That's not who we are."
Right.
This was his way of
aggressive.
Subtly, it was very aggressive without seeming to be. So it seemed, as he so often did, perfectly gentlemanly and debonair even. But in fact, it's very coercive. It's saying, you know, if you don't share my view of this, you're not one of us. It's a way of defining us. I'd be very slow to define people out of America, including people who have views that I find distasteful or noxious or even dangerous. That used to be the liberal way. That used to be, you know, if you go back and read Anthony Lewis, who I once described as writing a column in the New York Times that was the equivalent of listening to an air raid siren, but it was an air raid siren in favor of unvarnished liberalism, the old variety that really believed in free speech.
Yes,
you go back and look at some of his writings about the speech that we detest. The toleration of that being the test of our democracy. Where has that gone? You know, it's just astonishing how missing it is. So somehow that has to be reconciled with the need. We also need to recover a kind of affection for this country as a place that embraces that view of the human person, that is a high view of the human person as having a kind of need for the freedom to decide things by individual and collective deliberation, that we don't begin with a sort of set of givens from which everything has to proceed. I keep thinking one last thing I want to say, but we probably are into the fifth hour here. But
no, this is good, and it sparks mine that a republic, limited government, is precisely that. It's not trying to define all of human life for you. It assumes that you have a conscience and a soul and an aspiration to do that yourself.
Well, let me say something else that might be a little bit controversial, and I think another, in addition to teaching the conflicts, another dodge that we have used, and it isn't intrinsically a dodge, but it has become one, is the notion that what we are about teaching in our schools and colleges and universities is this thing called critical thinking. I think that's become a real wooden nickel of our the currency of our discourse, this notion of critical thinking, because it really does mean you don't have to take a position about anything. You don't have to affirm anything except the sort of freedom of the individual to dissent and disagree. I think education needs to be as much, it needs to be about that. It needs to be about coming out of the cave, as I said, but it also needs to be about learning to appreciate. Nobody thinks of, music appreciation courses as being part of a liberal education, but they are. Gaining the ability, the capacity for wonder, for the fullest possible appreciation of beauty, the sort of magnificent monuments of the past, of great literature, and of its inexhaustible properties, develop in students a disposition to sort of say, hey, here is something very big, very big, that I can learn from, and that my first disposition should not be to say, well, what did this guy know? He was a white male living in the Northeast, which actually I remember teaching David Reisman's The Lonely Crowd once at Tulane, and that was, and the students had not done the reading, so the way they got out of all my questions was saying, well, this is a guy that's just a white male, and this was 20 years ago. This guy's just a white male from the Northeast. What does he know? And then it dawned on me that critical thinking, particularly when it came to sort of identity politics, was a substitute for thinking. I'm a product of a great book, St. John's College undergraduate education, and one of the things, you couldn't get away with that at St. John's, because the whole presumption that everyone shared coming into the class was that there are great books. You might not like, I didn't like Hegel's Phenomenology of Spirit, and a few other, I didn't much like Descartes, but there was the greatness, the sense that the first thing you did was appreciate what does the world look like when you look at it through Hegelian lenses or Cartesian lenses or Platonic or whatever? This is somebody who's dug deep and dived deep. First of all, get what it is that they, to the extent you can grasp it, what they saw. And then and only then, sort of ask, well, were they perhaps mistaken? That's what we learned, and not by sort of precept, but by practice. I mean, that's simply, you can't have a two-hour seminar talking about how Plato was a white male from the Northeast and or Northeast part of Athens or whatever, the Piraeus. you can't get for 2 hours. You ultimately have to talk about the book.
Bill, I'm going to let our listeners somehow conjugate this with American patriotism.
Okay. Well, the point is, American patriotism is a many splendid thing, and it is. I've been thinking about my friend Bruce Cole, the late Bruce Cole, who was I had the privilege of serving on the National Council of the Humanities with him as chairman of the NEH. And Bruce was a scholar of the Italian Renaissance. I once sort of traipsed around Florence with him. He knew every alley and every little nook and cranny, but this was the most patriotic American that I've ever known. He was from Indiana, you know, the great state of Indiana, where you sit as we are talking. And he is a proud Hoosier. He absolutely knew who he was and had a sense of a man at home in the world that was his home, but also a man of the world. There's no reason why these have to be mutually exclusive categories. Cosmopolitanism is not Diogenes had it wrong. It's not a way of checking out of the world. It's not a way of saying to your interlocutors, I belong to no city-state. I am a citizen of the world. No, you can belong and belong deeply and yet also have a kind of openness to the wonder of this amazing world we live in.
Well put.
So, okay.
Thank you.
Well, great to talk to you.
This is your host, Richard Reinsch, and you have been listening to a podcast that can be found at libertylawsite.org, where you can subscribe, comment, and find other episodes and links related to today's conversation. Our email address is lal@libertyfund.org.